The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Yesterday morning here, someone asked a question that I would like to answer today. I answered it yesterday, but it's worthy of a longer reply. She asked, she pointed out that she'd read somewhere that some writer on Buddhism had said that if you wanted to become enlightened, you can't do it as a layperson living a householder life, and that you had to become a monastic, a monk or nun. And you know, I know her, and I know that's not in store for her anytime soon. She has two young children, and so she asked, you know, is it possible as a layperson living a life of children and work and all those things, is it possible to become enlightened? And so her question pointed out, you know, points to this big question in Buddhism that arises because Buddhism has monasticism. And almost at its very foundation, time of the Buddha, Buddha was primarily a monastic tradition. And down through the ages in Asia, the primary teachers of the tradition were monastics. And so those people who were looked up to as being the mature practitioners, those people who had matured enough in the practice to teach, were all monastics. And there were, of course, from time to time, lay people who also became Buddhist teachers, but they were really the exception rather than the rule. Even at the time of the Buddha, there were lay people who did become enlightened and were teachers of the Dharma. So, you know, the great majority were monastics. And in Asia, there was oftentimes, most of the time, a very sharp dichotomy between the practice of lay people and the practice of monastics. Monastics were, if anybody was meditating, it was monastics. The monastics would study the Dharma, they would teach the Dharma, they would practice the Dharma, they'd meditate. And lay people, you know, some lay people would do that, they'd come to the monastery periodically, they might do a little bit of meditation. But the role of lay people was to live a good life, you know, ethical life. And for many of them, it was to cultivate merit. And merit was cultivated by making offerings to the monastics. And the monastics would be fed, and monasteries would be built. And the responsibility of the monastics in return was to teach. And so there was a reciprocal relationship of the laity offering support for the monastics and the monastics teaching in return. It set up, that dichotomy set up a lot of interesting issues in Buddhism. One of the issues, a big issue, is what is the relationship of monastics and laity? And so you can imagine that if the monastics are always the teachers, that it sets up a hierarchy. And so we find at times in Buddhism an elitism goes on, where the laity are treated sometimes a little bit like children, where they're taught, they're kind of sometimes even talked down to, and taught kind of very simply sometimes, and often taught very simple kind of ethical rules what to live by. So much so that even at the time of the Buddha, there's a famous, the story of the most famous disciple of the Buddha, a lay disciple, one of the most famous lay disciples, is a very wealthy man who donated to the Buddha one of his monasteries where the Buddha lived for a long time. And as he was dying, one of the Buddha's disciples went to him to see him and gave some teachings about kind of the ultimate nature of liberation and consciousness. And this man, Anathapindika, said, wow, I've never heard this before. Why, you know, why isn't this taught to the lay people? You know, there are lay people who'd get it. So it was kind of, you know, we don't know the full context of all this and what the Buddha taught, but the story points to the idea that, you know, certain things are taught to the laity, certain things are more often than not, certain things are taught to monastics. This changed a lot over the in history of Buddhism, has changed a fair amount in modern times. And you find, starting in probably the 1940s in Burma, early in Sri Lanka, later in Thailand, but, you know, so 40s is a good time to think of it, beginning, there was became a much stronger movement to bring meditation to the lay people. And so you can go to monasteries now in countries like Thailand and Burma, and as a lay person, as a Burmese Thai lay person, as a Western lay person, and be welcome to come and do meditation practice. And some of the lay people who have practiced deeply have been sanctioned in those traditions to go and teach, come back to America and be teachers. But this is quite unusual. It's still not the norm. And I don't know how many lay teachers have been sanctioned in Burma, but they've sanctioned some of the Westerners to go back and be lay teachers in the West. So what happens here in the West is kind of in some regards the reciprocal of what happened historically in Asia. Here in this country, most of the, like in our tradition, Theravada tradition, most of the teachers of Buddhism, the Theravada teachers, are lay people. And very few of the teachers are monastics. Whereas in Asia, it's the other way around. Most of the teachers are monastics and very few are laity. And it points to the idea that here in the West, we have a whole new relationship to how we practice Buddhism, we engage in Buddhism, and associations we have. People can come to IMC and see that I'm a lay person, I have family and all that, and if this is the only Buddhism they know, they say, well, you know, of course, you know, I could do it too. Perhaps. And then if you go to, you know, hang out with monastics and you say, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm supposed to, you know, if that's the model of what, how he's supposed to be, am I supposed to now renounce my life and become celibate and give up my money and shave my head and, you know, and go off and live in a monastery and wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning? And is that what it takes? And then you hear teachings periodically in Buddhism that, yes, that's what it takes. And some of that is lore. Like one of the pieces of interesting lore that has no basis, any evidence that the Buddha ever taught this, but it crept into the tradition at some point and became kind of a often repeated lore. Sometimes people didn't see it as lore, they took it as gospel. Is that it's so important to be a monastic that while it's possible for a layperson to become fully enlightened, it is possible, they admit. But if you don't get ordained within 7 days of your full enlightenment, you'll die. Somehow the structure of the universe has been constructed in such a way that that seems to be the way things unfold. So I call it lore, that kind of belief. And though I did appreciate that piece of lore when I went to India in the early, mid-80s, and I don't know if it was true, India was like this back at the time of the Buddha, but, you know, if you get enlightened, you become really honest and open and generous. And the India that I saw when I was there, it's a lot of different parts of India and different ways of seeing it, it was very hard for me to imagine someone surviving as a layperson with that kind of attitude. And in fact, maybe that's one of the reasons why monasticism is so respected there. It's understood there's a whole form of renunciant tradition in India where people know how to relate to them, and you can relate to them much more generously because they don't have anything you can take from them. And what I saw in India was that people really wanted what I had. And if I said, sure, take it. you know, I probably wouldn't have survived more than 7 days. You know, something like that. I don't know if that's... And I don't know if that's a fair assessment of the situation, but I did see that, I did feel that monasticism protects someone, when society protects or supports someone in an obvious way, who perhaps doesn't have a certain kind of drive that is needed in some kind of cultures. Here in this country, you go into this store and you kind of expect to get, the price is set. And so you just, pay what's being said, what's being asked, and you have to worry about being cheated or whatever, or be challenged around that. And in some countries, you go and you ask them what the price is, and they can tell you very interesting prices. And the expectation is you're supposed to bargain, and haggle back and forth, and it's some people like doing that. But I can't imagine someone who's enlightened is going to stand there and haggle. So they said, sure, take it all. I had, when I was in Thailand, first time I was there, I was kind of hosted by a Western Buddhist monk. And he was a little bit loose with the rules. But one of the rules is you can't touch money. You can't do that. So he wouldn't touch money, but he had a little purse where he had his money in. And so we took a taxi in Bangkok. And when we got to the end of the ride, he took out his purse and he handed it to the taxi driver. And he said, take what you want. So the taxi driver took, his amount and returned the purse. So that's the way he protected his rule. That's a nice story. So to add to this little issue of, what can lay people do in terms of Buddhist practice, depth of Buddhist practice, how mature, how far can they really go in this practice of ours? To add the complexity of this is in our particular part of Theravada Buddhism, the insight meditation movement, it was started in the West as a retreat movement. And the teachers like Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield came back from Asia, and they were primarily interested in teaching retreats. And so they taught a lot of retreats. And people who were interested in what they had to teach heard teachings on retreats that about being on retreat. And people got into it. And you can get into the habits, like a habit you develop, the retreat habit. And the message that some people picked up was, if you're really serious about your practice, you go and retreat. And so then people say, well, I can't go and retreat as much as it seems to be championed. I have to work, I have family to take care of, old parents to take care of, I have kids to take care of, I have issues I have to deal with. And so am I left out of the spiritual life because I can't go and retreat so much? I'm lucky if I can go once a week, once a month. I mean, once a year is what I meant to say. A week a year. And these people are going off for 3 months, 6 months, on retreat. And how can they do that? How can they afford it? How can they just drop out of their life? I can't do that. And so there are not a few people who felt left out, felt angry or upset, felt sad, grief, because they felt that the depth of practice wasn't available to them, even though they stayed as lay people. And so they ask, what can we do as lay people? Can we in our lives practice, can we get enlightened, as the woman asked on Sunday? So that's the question. And to answer the question, I'm not sure exactly where to begin, but it's a multifaceted issue. And so we have to kind of look at this issue from many different angles. But one of the angles we have to look at that's really important for any of us is to really ask, what is it that your intention is for your practice, for your life? What's most important for you? And in fact, that's what I asked the woman yesterday, because I felt I wasn't so sure in the few minutes we had I was going to engage her in this issue of enlightenment. So I thought, maybe I should check with her first. And asked her, what does that means for you? What are you hoping for? What are you hoping for when you talk about, becoming enlightened? And she said, I just want to be more mindful and less reactive. She said one more thing, but I couldn't remember what the three things were. But basically, And so I said, oh, well, you can, certainly as a lay person, you can learn that. You don't have to become a monastic to do that. You don't have to go on retreats to do that. There's a lot to be learned in lay life, and you can develop, mature a lot in that way. So you have to look at, you know, what is your intention? What do you want? And a lot of the people who listen to teachings of Buddhism and see the example of monastics or teachers like myself who've gone on retreats for a long time and think, oh, we're supposed to model ourselves on them, or we're supposed to believe what they say what's good for us. And I think it's actually important to listen to what people say, but then check it out for yourself and explore yourself. What really makes sense for me? What do I most want? And then once you have a sense of that, you can say, well, how can I fulfill that? What is suitable for that? One of the reasons why that's very important is that to follow any spiritual path seriously requires a rearranging of one's priorities. And you have to, and that means you have to choose between different priorities you have. And if it's really important enough for you, you're willing to sacrifice things that are less important. Someone who wants to become, a great athlete or a great musician or something, you know, really, it's not as common in our society for people to make decisions, choices. I'm going to follow this particular thing and not other things. And we feel okay about that. Someone who wants to be an Olympic athlete, that's what they do, and they don't do much else. Someone goes to college and they really focus on that. And there's a lot of things they can't do because that's what they're focusing on. And so the same thing with the spiritual life. If you understand what you want and how important it is for you, then you can start asking the question, what are you willing to sacrifice in order to pursue that? So it might be that, for example, in our tradition, there's people I know who feel it's very important to go on retreat. They don't get a lot of vacation time during the year, but that's what they do in their vacation. It's a little bit unfortunate not to have regular vacation time for the couple of weeks they have, but they decide to go on retreat. Or people say, you know, it can be much more daily kind of decision, that meditation is important for me. And it's important to meditate in a committed way. And, you know, I can manage to meditate 20 minutes a day. That's nice. But, you know, if I'm really serious about this, I think I should do more than 20 minutes. What if I do an hour a day? But I can't do an hour a day. How do I fit that into my busy life? Well, you fit it into your busy life by perhaps giving up some things. Perhaps you give up reading the morning paper. The morning paper is not that important. Most people don't remember a year later what they read and so perhaps there's other ways of getting the news. Or maybe there's certain things we do that, you know, we can put aside. Americans watch a phenomenal amount of television. You say, well, I need to unwind. I come home, I need to unwind. I need to unwind so I can meditate in the morning. And perhaps unwinding through television can be let go of. And perhaps meditation is a more effective way of unwinding, even though initially it seems like a little hurdle to sit down and do the effort. So to look at our life, and the opportunities for practice in lay life are very similar to the opportunities to practice in monastic life. It just has a different kind of association. Monastic life is a little bit easier because you have the group support. The whole thing is kind of dripping in kind of Buddhist spirituality, Buddhist, you know, atmosphere, so it feels like it's special. You know, you go wash dishes in the monastery, it's like, you know, part of your practice, you're washing dishes, you know. And it's like, feels like it's special. Wash dishes at home, and, you know, does it have the same, you know, kind of atmosphere of sacredness? It's as effective practice to wash your dishes at home as it is to wash it in the monastery. And I should have gotten my training in Zen monasticism. I should have got my certificate, you know, in Zen training for being the head dishwasher at Tassajara. And did a lot of dishwashing. Boy, I loved it. And it was a very full-on kind of practice. And I've washed dishes at home, and I've done dishes at home, feeling, you know, let's get this over with and get on with life, do important things. This doesn't really count. And I've done dishes at home, and this is what I'm doing, and enter into it fully, the dishwashing. And when I enter into it fully and just are there, then it becomes a spiritual practice. I've been a monk where we had puja, where we had all kinds of forms of worship as part of it, and monastic life has a lot of chanting and bowing, and some people really like that stuff, and again, it feels like it gets into the atmosphere of all of it and feels good, and you know, I've walked up to the altar and bowed, and very reverentially and mindfully, and got full presence, kind of stuck the incense into the incense bowl, and bowed, and walked back. It's nice, if you're into it. And then there's taking the clean dishes out of the dishwasher, lifting it up with two hands, and placing it on your shelf, leaving it there and walking back, walking away. Why is it? Why are the two different? Why do they have to be so different from each other? What you imbue your activities with affects how you train, how you develop, how you grow in this practice here. If you imbue putting the dishes from the onto your shelf with no significance at all as being kind of like not really any kind of, doesn't have any practice value at all, it won't have any. But if you see it as something where you can develop mindfulness and presence, where you can offer a lot of care and respect to the object there, it can have as much impact on you as doing daily puja, daily worship in the monastery, over and over again. So how many of the, so people say, well, I'm too busy to practice. You know, I'm doing all this different, you know, I can't practice. But usually when they say that, they mean they can't meditate. But how many people wash dishes? Or fold your laundry, or drive your car, or go shopping, or, you know, I love Thomas Merton was a famous Catholic monk, and someone asked him, oh, after all your years of monasticism, what did you learn? And he said, I learned to open and close doors. Something really mundane and ordinary. Do you open and close doors? Do you open and close doors as if the opening doors, closing the door, is part of your spiritual practice? And how would you do it if it was? Is it a place to cultivate mindfulness, concentration, presence? Or do you open and close doors as if this has nothing to do with my training myself, developing myself, and I'm just opening and closing those doors so I can get on with my life, so I can work, and work, make a lot of money so I can go on retreat, so I can really do I can really do the practice. You know, that's kind of silly, you know. Eventually I'll really get to do the practice. So this is an important point because it also points to the idea of what is it that's being developed in the kind of spiritual development that we do in Buddhism. There's been sometimes a very narrow idea among many people I know of what spiritual development is. The narrowest one is you sit down, you get concentrated, and you get enlightened. And let's just get on with it. You know, so let's go and sit on retreat and huff and puff and get enlightened. And another approach is that spirituality has to do with cultivating, developing all aspects of our human being. And so all of who we are, all our personality qualities are shaped and cultivated and refined. Our intellect, our heart, our emotions, our physical body. It's all the breadth and width of what it means to human being is brought into the practice and affected by the practice. So this is important because I've known people who've done really serious, deep retreat practice. I've known people even been monastics, been monks for a long time. And not only doesn't seem to have made them better people, I wonder if it made them worse people. Sometimes they get arrogant. Or they get really kind of uptight, or they get kind of really narrow-minded and sectarian, like this is the true way, and you feel it, just kind of like you feel kind of tense around them, or feel like you're being judged, or you don't feel kind of a person who's at peace with themselves, at peace with the world, and relaxed and open, and somehow. So would you rather be an enlightened jerk? Or would you rather be someone who has the skills and the qualities of generosity and kindness that can help their neighbors and their friends and their community. Hopefully you don't have to kind of, ideally you don't keep those things two worlds separate, the world of enlightenment and the world of kindness, but you know, what I'm pointing to is there's a lot of things to be developed. And so certain things get developed on retreats, the capacity for concentration, the capacity for deep stillness, sometimes deep insight into the quiet corners of the mind. But different things are cultivated in daily life. You know, usually in daily life you can't be so still and quiet, but daily life is a great place to cultivate your kindness, to cultivate your generosity, to cultivate your compassion, your love. It's a great place to cultivate mindfulness. One of the really great practices to do that is to cultivate mindfulness of speaking. I probably learned more about mindfulness of speaking and my relationship to it in lay life than I did in monasteries. Though in the monasteries I had a great practice. And that was, we had a lot of silence in the monasteries. Like at the Zen monasteries, we would have the first, I don't know, 6 hours of the day were done in silence. And at some point, the silence was broken, but it wasn't like we just immediately started talking. It was understood that you could start talking now, and then as things unfolded the day, we just run into someone, we'd talk or something. So I made it my practice to try to be very attentive to the first speech act of each day. And the quality of it, what the intention behind it was, why I was speaking, what the impact I had, and all this stuff. And I found that very valuable. So that was my monastic practice. But there's no reason any of you can't do that. Most of you don't talk through the night. So, you know, there's a time when you start practicing after you wake, start talking when you wake up. And what happens, to really kind of give extra care to that first speech act. What is that like? You know, as you leave your home, you go to work, you go out, you know, to the store or something, I don't know what you do. But at some point you speak to someone. And to give extra care, you learn a lot about yourself in that approach to, you know. This is a little bit of a non sequitur, but I was thinking about this today. I'm planning to go away tomorrow morning, so I do a lot of preparations. And so when you're doing a lot of preparation stuff, my mind was kind of like in this preparation mode. It was like thinking and planning and organizing and thinking what I had to do. And so it's kind of like in this kind of treadmill of thinking. And so near the end of the day, I went to the main post office here in Redwood City to mail some things. And there was a long line. So when I was standing there in a long line, then I really noticed the momentum of my mind, this planning, thinking, organizing mind, you know, what I have to do and all that, and how I was in this mode. But then I quickly realized that I didn't have to be in that mode anymore because I was just standing there. I wasn't going anywhere, you know. It was like I couldn't do anything except stand there. So this is a great time to let go of that spinning mind and be quiet. So it was great. I stood there. I closed my eyes for a little bit, and it was relatively quick and easy for me to quiet the mind and just sit there. And it was very satisfying just to be there, standing there, without the mind jumping around and spinning. I've done exactly the same thing in monasteries when I was a monk. Busy doing things during the day, doing all that kind of stuff, and then we have a very important ceremony or a very important event, and all the monks, nuns line up, things are not going as fast as they should, we're standing there, guess what? Get to practice with that. So lay life offers lots of wider range of opportunities to practice and train in different things than we can do on retreat or often in monasteries as well. And so in some ways it's much richer for practice. It's also more challenging because of all the demands and everything. So some people think of lay life as kind of like remedial practice. And other people think of it as advanced practice. And the remedial practice is the monastic practice. You shouldn't think of it as either one is remedial. But monastic practice is a beautiful way of practicing because it's designed to try to make the practice as available and easy as possible. So if what you most want to do in your life, the only thing you want to do is to practice all the time and really have that be part of your life in a clear and supported way, it's usually easier to do it in the monastery. There aren't all the kind of demands we have in daily life on you. However, there are plenty of... The fact that someone is a monastic and living that in a monastery doesn't necessarily mean that they're taking advantage of that opportunity. In fact, in places like Thailand and Burma, most monks don't meditate. We often associate that with monastics, they're the meditators, but most don't. And you know, when I was in Thailand, I saw plenty of monks who sat around during the day watching television. And now there are some, a minority who are very serious practitioners who really take advantage, or not advantage, but really respect and honor that life that they have and really use it really well to the full potential of what it is. And it's a beautiful, some of the monastics we meet are beautifully inspiring people. It's really clear the depth of the practice and how much they've done. So it's a great, great lifestyle. But it's very important not to assume that everyone has the same path. That every path of practice is suitable for every individual. So, but not assume that any particular path is suited for everyone. So the monastic path is well suited for some people. Some people have a disposition that orients them to that life, it just suits their personalities. Some people have a tremendous amount of suffering in their life that nothing else makes sense but to kind of do that. Some people, some people it suits for them. And some people find the monastic life really gets in there and challenges them really at the depths of their life. So for example, one of the big challenges that a lot of people have in their lives is around relationship with other people, especially sexual relationships. And now there are a few individuals here and there who just kind of sail through life, a very easy sexual life, come and go, hold it very lightly, and easy come, easy go, and it's just very nice, smooth, easy sailing. They can do without that, it's fine, and they can do with it, it's fine, and whatever's fine. But those are few and far between. And so the world of sexuality and sexual desire is a complicated world for many people. And so some people find by going off and being monastics, where they're celibate, that challenges them to no end. Their desires, their hormones, flare up and much more powerfully than they can if they have an outlet for their sexuality. And so they have to kind of grapple and wrestle with their sexuality in a powerful way to really get to the root and the bottom of it and understand it and somehow be liberated from being pushed around by that desire. Other people find that their sexual life was complicated and difficult and a headache and whatever, and they just love being monastics. I don't have to think about it. And so they find they're not challenged, not wrestling with some deep attachment. They just put it aside, and now they're able to kind of have a simpler mind, easier, their life simpler and more relaxed and more peaceful because of that whole complication that's not going on. And they find that creates conditions that allows them to settle deeply and do some really deep inner spiritual work. So that's nice. So two different kinds of approaches. Now some people find that that going off on in a monastery, being celibate, is not such a big deal. It's easy enough, and it's nice. But they don't wrestle with sexuality. It's just, they basically put it, they shelve it for a while, and then they come out of the monastery, stop being monastic, they go back into lay life, and boom. There it is. It was waiting for them. And now they realize, well, I have to really deal with this. And for me to deal with this, I have to deal with this. I can go back to the monastery, but then I'm really running away from it. I really need to get to the bottom of my particular kind of complicated relationship with sexuality. So that's just one example, but there's many things like that. So for some people, monastic life challenged them in deep ways. For some people, monastic life doesn't challenge them. It provides really wonderful conditions. It allows them to go deep. Other people, because of their disposition, whatever conditions of their life, lay life is really what's right for them. For some people, lay life is where they get challenged most deeply. And it's a really good place to be challenged and to wrestle with those things. And to run away from lay life and not deal with it, it doesn't really allow us to grow and mature. So, for example, in my situation, monastic life was relatively easy compared to raising a family. And so I was really surprised by all the attachments that I had that I didn't know I had. And so, for example, one of the attachments I had was that, I turned out I was attached to being able to pursue what I thought was a spiritual life without any limits. When I was a single and without kids, I can go on retreat and I can go sit as much as I want. I could go study as much as I want. I could, listen to Dharma talks as much as I want. I'm not attached to any of those things. Just they're there and I'm just doing them. Thank you. And there's not a problem. And then I had kids. And then I could see I actually had this strong desire for all kinds of activities that were easy before. And now I couldn't do them. And I got to see that actually I was attached to them. And so then I had to deal with that. There was a number of options I had. I could have turned my kids back in.
Refund.
What?
Refund.
Or I could have tried to deal with this. And I really took what was going on with me and explore and just understand it. And so for me, the kind of person I am, it was really important for me, I feel, to be able to have family because it really, really challenged me in ways that I wasn't being challenged as a monastic. To look at all kinds of issues. And so there's a trade-off, and the trade-off was I didn't go so much on long retreats anymore. For me, I felt lucky that I did that early in life. So I did a lot of retreats. So I feel like I did my share. But still, once I had kids, to go on long retreats. So there's certain kind of development, practice, I wasn't able to do so much anymore, but I was able to do other kinds very much. And I feel like I benefited from it. Remember once, when three or four years old, and I was talking with a friend, and I said, oh, I'd really like to go on retreat again. And then I heard myself say that, and as I heard myself say it, I kind of filled in the rest of it. I said to myself, oh, I really want to go on retreat so I can get some relief. Whereas actually, practice opportunities are being given to me on a silver platter. And it's a matter of how I address it and engage in it. So all this requires that each of us know ourselves relatively well. We have to know what we want and what is beneficial, what's most supportive for us, what helps us, what challenges us in a good way, what creates the conditions that are most supportive for us to look at ourselves and look in deep ways and develop the kind of qualities we want to develop. We want to develop greater capacity for mindfulness, greater capacity for kindness, patience, greater capacity for honesty, greater capacity for compassion, for resolve, for being determined and following through on what we're going to do, for equanimity. Where can we cultivate these things the best? All those qualities are not the same thing as becoming liberated. And some people hold liberation up as the be-all and end-all. And anything else and everything else is kind of child's play, not important, kind of besides the point. Other people hold the idea that cultivating these other kind of qualities and becoming broad in one's spiritual development creates a broad, firm foundation that supports an easier and more mature form of liberation when it finally happens. When I was a new Zen student, one of my Zen teachers said that in Zen there are two primary schools of Zen. There's the Rinzai school of Zen and the Soto Zen school. And the difference is the Rinzai school, in the focuses more on as quickly as you can getting enlightened. And the Soto school takes its time. The Rinzai school is called the soldier's way, or the general's way, the samurai way or something. The Soto Zen is called the farmer's way. You plant a seed, you cultivate your ground, and slowly things grow. And then he drew on the blackboard, he was giving a lecture, he drew a graph of spiritual growth over time. And so in the Rinzai school, time is the bottom axis, and the horizontal and spiritual growth is the vertical axis. So in the Rinzai school, the growth was very fast over time, went very high, just very steep curve. And then it flattened out, and it was very gradual over a long time. The Soto way was very, very gradual over a long, long time. And then eventually, it met and joined the Rinzai line. So two different approaches. Both are fine approaches. Who's going to say one's better than the other? And who's to say what's right for you? If you're a lay person with a busy life, perhaps you're the farmer's approach. And you're setting the seeds for something. You're growing and developing and creating really wide conditions. If you have the capacity for it, you maybe do the Rinzai approach and you go deep, really far. Ideally, over time, you become both deep and broad and wide. You don't want to just be deep or just go high, whatever your analogy is. You want to have a really firm base, wide base. You want to have a great breadth and width in your spiritual development. And so both approaches are very important, are valid. So what's right for you? So this requires you to do an assessment of yourself, your life, your intentions, your situation, what your needs are, what your conditions are, and figure out what is it that is important for you and how can you most follow through on what's important for you given your conditions. And there's many, many variables we play with. But absolutely, a lay person living the kind of lay life people have in this society can cultivate and develop themselves to a great degree in this practice. There's no shortage of what's possible. But it does require being intent, deciding this is what's really important, and being willing to make choices where you choose between different things. Sometimes between things which are healthy and not unhealthy. Sometimes it's between choosing between letting go of things that are good things to do, but we can't do it all. The more important the spiritual life is for you, the more it's necessary to make choices between many of the wonderful things you could be doing with your life. If it's only 10% important, then you offer 10% of your life to that kind of practice. If it's 50% important, then 50% of your life. So, what to say as a conclusion for all this? I think as a conclusion, I just want to repeat myself, because this is a very, very important point for me, is that we don't want to have a narrow, one-path idea of what Buddhist spiritual growth is like. There's many, many ways in which the inner heart, the life, mind cultivates, develops, matures. And there'll be a way that's unique to you, given your dispositions, your personality, your life story, and the conditions you find yourself in now. And so you have to take all that into account, and then taking that into account, decide what is your way. And then you have to have some ability periodically to really evaluate and assess, is this really working? Or am I fooling myself? And one of the great tests of really finding out, is this really working? Am I really getting to what needs to be, there's a number of things to how to test yourself, but one of the tests is once in a while, go on a retreat. Because something very different happens on retreats where you can kind of find out what's going on in a different kind of way. And if you're one of those people who goes on retreat a lot, that's all you do, then once in a while, you should go and get a job and a spouse and, you know, rent some kids for a week. She's offering it. And then you can test it and find out. So I hope that was helpful. And I hope also it was a little bit challenging for you to take your life more seriously. So thank you.